Welcome back to America's leading higher education podcast, The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hosts Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Leiba, and producer Elvin Freites bring you the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. We explore innovations, ideas, and issues in higher education and beyond, and hopefully have a little fun along the way. Now let's get to it.
Interested in some fresh marketing ideas that have been real-world tested by colleges and universities and actually work? We'd love to share. Come download MDT Marketing's free 2020 Marketing Strategies Guide, filled with stats and highlights on digital marketing initiatives exclusively for colleges and universities. Download the Strategies Guide for free at learn.mdtmarketing.com. MDT Marketing has been a leader in delivering marketing solutions for institutes of higher education since 1995. Come leverage our knowledge and download our strategies guide at learn.mdtmarketing.com.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. We interview the most influential minds in higher education today. Myself, Joe Salustio, and my co-host, Elizabeth Leiba. Liz, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
Well, I'm very excited. I hope you are too, because on the line, we have Dr. Andrew Flagel, president of the Consortium of Universities of the Washington Metropolitan Area. Andrew, how are you doing today?
I think I'm doing as well as everybody is these days, so thanks for asking. I think we're doing just fine.
Well, I'll tell you, I'd like to begin the episodes just asking how's your health, how's your family, how's your friends, your inner circle, if you will, doing amidst the COVID-19 crisis?
Sure. We've been very fortunate to ourselves be healthy. My son just finished his senior year in high school. So along with working with universities, I've been navigating the process of entry into a first year in the middle of a pandemic and getting ready in a couple weeks to drive him out to college. And other than that, our immediate friends have all done well. My mom's in her mid-70s and has been sheltering in place in Ohio. And so far, knock wood, she's doing okay. So we've had a couple of friends and family who have had COVID, but so far everyone's come out of it, thank God, okay on the other side.
Well, that's great to hear. It's great to have stories of people who are making it out okay and hopefully haven't been unaffected. There have been many that have been affected in much more serious ways, and we wish those people well during this very rough time. But let's transition into talking about higher education. Andrew, you're president of the Consortium of Universities of the Washington Metropolitan Area. It kind of goes without saying what that is. But let's assume we have a listener that has not ever heard of the Consortium of Universities of the Washington Metropolitan Area. So tell us what that is and what you guys do there.
So it goes without saying, so let's say it. So the consortium.
That's what we do at the EdUp Experience.
That's what we do, right. That's the best part of a podcast, is saying things that go without saying. So the 17 universities of the consortium span the entire national capital region, from the University of Maryland outside the Beltway to George Mason University at the other side. Our major community colleges, Northern Virginia Community College, University of the District of Columbia, which of course is also a baccalaureate and graduate university, Montgomery College and Prince George's Community College. It distinctly has the national federal universities, National Intelligence University, National Defense University and the War College, and the Uniform University of the Health Services. And then also has, of course, the major DC universities, Gallaudet, Howard, Georgetown, American, GW, Trinity, Catholic, Marymount. So it really spans. One of them will be upset that I probably left one out in the midst of that list, but it's a spectacular group of institutions. And the consortium itself is one of the oldest in the country, goes back to the 1930s as a course sharing agreement for the DC institutions, but over the past 90 years has evolved into an organization that represents the universities at the local and federal level, that looks for opportunities in collaboration and efficiencies across the institutions, things as diverse as developing college counseling programs throughout the region, through our Reach for Success program, to hosting the police academy for the campus police at all the DC institutions. We also work on issues of equity and access across the region, have a couple of large grant programs that supports the Department of Defense and placement of postdocs and other students in critical infrastructure roles. So the entire structure is really around whatever the 17 institutions most need us to be. And at the moment, that generally surrounds issues related to dealing with the COVID crisis.
So that's it? That's all you guys do? No, that's one heck of a list.
Actually, I shortened the list considerably because I figured you didn't want to use the entire podcast just to talk about what we do.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a good background. And you've begun your tenure there July 13th of this year. Is that correct?
Yeah. So as of today, I'm completing my third week. So I'm a veteran.
Wow. Well,
in COVID time, that's equivalent to 18 months. So I'm good.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's the question. You know, you've taken on a massive organization here representing 17 colleges and universities in the Washington metro area during what many are calling the most disruptive time in the history of higher education, particularly because of the disruptions to online learning and moving to online learning and repopulating campuses and all of these areas, like you said, related to the COVID-19 crisis. So are you, the first question I think our listeners have, are you sure that you want to do this? But I mean, how did you rationalize through this this presidency? I mean, how do you sit at home with your family and friends and go, okay, I'm going to walk into this job leading 17 colleges and universities through a consortium during this time? How did that process go mentally for you?
Yeah, I think it all good decisions and careers start with your values and what you're committed to. And I started my planning for college wanting to follow in my mother's footsteps. She was an activist, and she'd been a school teacher and became an activist and politician and community economic development coordinator in Ohio, really championing opportunities for vulnerable populations and redeveloping districts to try to provide better housing, schools, and access. And I thought I would go into politics to do that and went to D.C. with that intention. Our family fell on some hard times. I became one of those in food insecure students that we talk about much more robustly now. And as I went through college, continuing to have the support of my family, I had the opportunity, necessity, to work in almost every office on campus and started to develop a real passion for working in higher education. And I was fortunate to be at GW and have some really phenomenal mentors who encouraged me in that direction. And it started a career-long interest in how we could transform higher education to provide better access, better support, better student success, and eventually to really transform the economy and the workforce. So that has led me from DC to Flint, Michigan, back to DC, up to Boston, and now back to DC to work with institutions that I really love and that I believe are some of the most transformative and innovative and equitable institutions in the country, just to have the chance to work with my alma mater, but also with George Mason and Gallaudet, with Trinity and Howard and UDC. I mean, Catholic University, these institutions are legendary for their mission-driven approaches to education. And I think if you allow yourself to lead not just with your head, but enough with your heart that you're making decisions that you're passionate about, it's rare that you'll make the wrong decision. So taking on a challenge where you're thrown into the deep end and still figuring out how to dog paddle is a lot more palatable when you're that committed to the work.
Thank you for that. You know, before Liz jumps in, because I know she's going to have a lot of questions based on what you said, but you used the word transform probably four or five times in various sentences.
Oh, good. I wouldn't want to repeat myself at all.
Yeah, right. Can you name the five spots that you used transform? No. Use transform to describe higher education, that higher education needs to transform or is transforming. How do you... Yeah. Why do you think that, and how does it need to transform?
Well, first is that higher education should be far more accessible and more equitable. It has not been inclusive. I think it has done a far better job than most individuals think at meeting workforce needs, but we need to do a far better job of mapping that and making that transparent and making that flexible and stackable. And I think that there is a tremendous, really almost untapped opportunity to expand our service model and the success of that service model. So if you look at just who goes to college, how successful those students are at getting through, graduating from, and being placed into opportunities, those two factors need to change radically. And then we need to, I think, make smaller adjustments, but much more transparent adjustments around how we're meeting the needs of the future workforce, which I really think the United States style education that's evolved is the best in the world at doing that. I'm not sure we've been as transparent at explaining that, particularly translating those factors to the business community.
Liz.
Yeah, this is all like really fascinating stuff for me because I have a special place in my heart for those marginalized students that may not have the access. I'm a faculty member and come from what could reasonably be considered a disadvantaged background. So I really want to drill down and talk about some of the programs because I think one of the areas in terms of just recapturing the public trust and helping to improve some of our numbers in terms of retention, in terms of graduation rates, especially among those marginalized populations, we have to recover that amount of trust where, you know, parents are sending their students off to college and they expect them to graduate, you know, or people are re-careering and maybe they're already, they're adults and they want to get a degree, but it's hard to juggle their responsibilities with trying to upskill themselves and make sure that they're still able to be functional and provide a paycheck and make their responsibilities and keep the household afloat. So there's so many different areas that higher education has had to navigate. And I think COVID has really brought this to the forefront, the recent social unrest and some of the refocusing on areas in terms of inequity has really brought that to the forefront and the role that education plays. So talk to us a little bit about some of the programming that you have. I saw that you have the Reach for Success program. You definitely come from a legacy yourself in terms of advocacy and wanting to be a change agent. How does your organization, in terms of those 17 colleges and universities, how do you provide that support system, that scaffolding for students? You have Howard, the illustrious Howard University, HBCU, where my beloved and esteemed sorority, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, was founded in 1913. You are definitely
You slipped in that plug nicely. That was well done.
Don't you love that?
Yeah, so, nice.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I didn't expect a sorority plug in the midst of that. That was nice.
There you go. I just slide those in there. You know, we're discreet there. So we have so many students that are coming from all these different varieties of backgrounds. how in the in terms of the mission and what you're able to provide as far as support services for all those different variety of colleges and universities, are you able to ensure that we're not only recruiting these students from all these diverse backgrounds, but we're also providing the support? And how do you maybe provide some advice for schools that may not have those resources, but what can they do to provide some better resources so they can improve outcomes for these marginalized students, especially going forward in the months ahead where things are going to be a little bit more challenging even than normal?
So there's a lot to unpack in what you just asked. So let me tackle it broadly first, and then drill down into this unprecedented crisis that we're all facing. But I want to start by actually pushing back a little on how diverse our students are. They certainly are diverse, but not nearly diverse enough. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that we need to challenge ourselves in, and you're seeing some of this discussion, not nearly enough, but some of it around the test, the standardized testing issue that's been raised with the COVID crisis. But the reality is, our systems tend to replicate themselves, and our institutions that are perceived to have the most prestige remain woefully less diverse than our population. And so we have a long way to go in terms of serving the diversity. And when you look at the shift in our demography, on race, on age, on every measure, our universities are not reflective of our society. So first is we have a long way to go at our colleges and universities. Probably the best example of success is our community colleges, which I think really represent the tapestry of our communities much more robustly. But then you get into how can we really transform success at our institutions. And there's a lot of components and a lot of experts who have studied this for a long time. I'll touch on three or four areas that I think are really imminent in terms of universities beginning to change their approach. One is our whole approach to student service, which began changing in the 90s and early 2000s around one-stop shops. But the reality is most students who come to universities still look at this incredibly bureaucratic, siloed set of structures that are very reactive. We wait until a student's in some kind of academic difficulty or already dropping out before something gets activated to support them. And you're beginning to see models that have cropped up in the last few years that, this is really being accelerated by some fascinating technology around AI and what's considered nudge technology, the idea that you can be pushed and navigated into different ways around your technology use, that you can be proactive in coaching and guiding students towards success from the beginning. And we really need to begin thinking about this holistically. If you look at the best programs in student success, they're reaching all the way down to the middle school levels and supporting students all the way through. So this model where we think of advising as something that only happens when a student comes and knocks on your door, as opposed to a proactive coaching model where we're reaching out to students and really encouraging them, promoting them, connecting them with mentors, connecting them with tutors, doing all the things that engage them as they go through the process. And there's great examples from the Posse Foundation all the way through that things like cohorts, mentorships, and ongoing intervention and guidance radically transform student success levels. So that's one set of pieces of data, and I'll also highlight the Pathways in Advance program between George Mason University, Northern Virginia Community College, and the Fairfax County Schools as an example where that's been really successful. And then you might look at some of the data that's developed out of my prior institution, the Association of American Colleges and Universities, where they have a division focused on STEM transformation that has looked at really retraining STEM faculty to be more cognizant of how they're teaching diverse students, more aware of how to diversify their own curriculum, and having tremendous success at increasing student success levels, particularly among more diverse students. And I think that is really an undermined area of potential leveraging some of that data that's out there. I'll also point to some of the work that's being done through AACNU and with a variety of institutions around truth, racial healing, and transformation centers. That I just got done talking with a group that's suggesting that we do far better research into student attitudes, and this ties into your question about COVID. At this moment, as students are coming to campus, how think of kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We spend a lot of time thinking about the upper level of self-actualization and student preparation, but at the base level, do students feel safe? Are they fed? And I think of what the Center for Hope at Temple University has talked about. If students are wondering where their next meal is coming from, if they're not being housed well, if they are not feeling safe on their campus for a whole variety of reasons around race and sexuality, then how can that student be expected to be really successful? And so I think we have to transform our society at the same time we're transforming our campuses. We have to face the systematic racism that's inherent in our institutions head on. And as we begin making those transformations, we on all of those fronts at the same time, they're not individualized components. As we begin addressing those comprehensively, just as three examples, I think you'll begin seeing success rates really accelerate. And then at the same time, we have to connect all those dots to the workforce. We have to be not doing this in our own ivory towers, in our own siloed environments, but doing this collaboratively with the corporate world, who really want to see a much more robust number of students coming through our doors, going out into their institutions, and we need to be the enablers that's helping that happen. But I want to emphasize, this is happening. This is not me talking about, finally, I'm here as the president and I'm going to bring this change. These are changes that one of the things that excites me about working with these 17 institutions is many of them have been deeply immersed in doing this transformative work in a really leading edge way. You look at the work of Montgomery College with the University of Maryland, the work that AU and Georgetown have done, at Georgetown Center for the Workforce. There's just example after example of how these institutions have invested in their communities and in their students to begin leading the edge of that transformation.
And I have one more question, Andrew. In terms of, we're talking about transformation, we're talking about student outcomes, we're talking about supporting the students and finding ways to be more effective and making sure that we provide them with workforce readiness skills and make sure that obviously we graduate them. If we can't graduate them, we can't get them into the workforce. How does faculty play into that? You have so many different organizations and institutions, and like you said, there's a big variety in terms of from an HBCU where faculty could sometimes be 60% Black, as opposed to more of a traditional environment where, I mean, some of the numbers are really astonishing, where you have only 5% maybe of Black faculty. And in recent surveys, even though 90%+ of colleges and universities agree that it's important to diversify faculty, only maybe 50% have a concrete plan of how to make that happen. How do we get that number closer together where we're actually seeing, because we've been talking about it. We've been talking about it for decades, that we have to make sure that the faculty are more reflective of the student body. And even if the student body isn't as diverse, they're still going to benefit from having a Black faculty or another person of color that they can really understand and get to a better place in terms of collaboration between different ethnic backgrounds and making sure that they have those role models. So what would you advise for colleges and universities to come up with concrete plans that really address this in a more meaningful and measurable way?
Well, I wish I had a silver bullet for it, but I will say that part of it is understanding the systematic racism that's built into a number of areas of promotion and tenure. Because our tenure systems have been so built around the publisher-parish system, and that publication system itself has been demonstrated again and again to have some tremendous bias in who is selected for publication. We have set up inherent barriers in the system that make it so much harder to accelerate Black, Latinx, all the diverse voices that we ought to be amplifying. And so I think that happens on a couple of sides. One is some of the leading work that's being done around thinking boldly about the tenure systems at many institutions. Many institutions are really pushing back on not just models of tenure, but how we're selecting where things are published and how we do our selection criteria for hiring. So it's not an area where I've spent a lot of time in research because I've spent most of my career focused on the student side. But I do believe that faculty are powerful allies and engagers. I think all too often we view faculty when your podcast kind of focuses on the business of higher ed. And so the folks who are really interested in the business of higher ed often see faculty as resistors. And that has not been my experience. I think faculty are so committed to their institutions and their students. And when presented with opportunities, especially when they're engaged in the change, I have found faculty to be the most powerful and thoughtful and brilliant allies at moving the ball forward.
And that's the key, engaging them, right?
That is exactly right. Yeah. But look, you know, I've been, I don't want to name drop, but some of the folks who brought me into my different institutions are the folks who are leading that change. And I'm so proud to have the opportunity to have worked with them and be associated with them and support the work that they do. And I think I am confident that change is coming. And I think it will come faster in higher ed than in many other sectors, because I think you have so many folks who are so committed to that work and recognize how big a change is needed.
Interested in some fresh marketing ideas that have been real-world tested by colleges and universities and actually work? We'd love to share. Come download MDT Marketing's free 2020 Marketing Strategies Guide, filled with stats and highlights on digital marketing initiatives exclusively for colleges and universities. Download the Strategies Guide for free at learn.mdtmarketing.com. MDT Marketing has been a leader in delivering marketing solutions for institutes of higher education since 1995. Come leverage our knowledge and download our strategies guide at learn.mdtmarketing.com.
Thank you.
Andrew, I want to take it just a different direction and go backwards just a tad.
Sure.
You know, we're probably going to have somebody listening to this that doesn't fully understand what a consortium is or does.
I may be among those.
So how does it work? You know, you have 17 member universities. Do they pay a tax? Do they make donations to the consortium? Is it funded outside of the universities and you provide services? Give me an idea of how functionally a consortium operates to service the member colleges.
Yeah, you know, it's much like many things at universities, it's a term that means different things depending on how the group is organized. So this particular consortium does have membership dues. That is, the bulk of our funding comes from some of the grants that we administer. And increasingly, I think the organization will look to develop new funding sources as we develop new ways of supporting our members. So you have, you know, the potential of growing your membership, of charging your membership more, or of finding, you know, cooler things that you can do that bring in new revenue to the organization. But there's consortia that are very focused on a particular set of practices. So there's a couple of big consortium, for instance, that are looking just at student success and they're working with a fairly homogenous institution, so big research universities all over the country, all in one consortium, looking at that issue and trying different things on their campuses around, and they're managed largely through huge grants with the big educational foundations. You have other consortium that have been around nearly as long as we have that are really built almost entirely around a course sharing arrangement, and they don't do a lot of these other functions or try to get into these other areas of coordination. So their footprint is much smaller and the dues from their members completely fund their operation. So it really depends on the function. I think this consortium, because it spans two states and the district, because of our locus within the nation's capital, because of the incredible profile of our institutions, and that we have served nearly 300,000 students and thousands of faculty and staff, we are a really unusual organization in having our potential fingers in so many different pies and thinking about creatively how we can be of greater service, not just to our institutions, but to the region. So one of the functions that's really developed in the past, I would say, couple of decades by my predecessors has been the consortium as an economic driver of the region. The higher education institutions in the National Capital Region are the largest employer largest non-governmental employer throughout the region. So we have more employees than any organizations collectively outside of government agencies. So that has a tremendous impact when you think about what that means in normal times in the economy, but particularly as we think about an economic recovery. Our role is not just producing the future workforce and supporting organizations coming in, but we are part of that workforce. We are a huge hiring engine in the region. So part of that responsibility means working with the economic development authorities, means thinking collectively across the region. What are our major corporations? What are our major economic drivers? And I think that's rather distinctive for our consortium than most. So what a consortium is, I would say that it's whatever my 17 presidents want me to be. And I will endeavor every day to be that for all 17 presidents.
Why don't we see more of these? We've been talking so much on the podcast over the past few months about resources, trying to put classes online, trying to update curriculum. And coming from the faculty and the instructional design side, I know that that can be a laborious process. There's so many different things and so much resources that need to be allocated to that. Why don't we see more models like this? And do you predict we're going to see more models post-COVID where schools don't have as many resources, schools are in danger of shutting down? Are schools going to kind of band together a little bit more in a similar kind of model where we have kind of like a little bit more of that collaborative
I think that's exactly right. I think the number of predictions of doom for the higher education industry, I'm friends with many of the folks who predict regularly on Twitter that, you know, a third of the institutions are going to shut down and everybody's going to get absorbed. And you do see some really creative things happening. And I don't doubt that there will be some institutions that will manage their way into dissolution. But I think the vast majority have the opportunity to think really creatively. Look, I was on a call earlier today about collective work across the region and across our institutions in cybersecurity. I've been on calls thinking really creatively about how we do a far better job. Look, I mentioned that we run a campus police academy. How do we think about the defund police movement when it comes to universities and community policing? And could we be national leaders and models of community policing? And is that something that we can do collectively more effectively than we could do independently? So absolutely, I think we are a 90-year trendsetter. So it's, as all things with higher education, sometimes a trend takes far longer than it would in any other industry. But I suspect that collaborations in consortia are one of the most effective tools that universities are going to have to address some of the tremendous financial disparity and financial challenges that we're seeing. And what I hope will happen is that we will use this moment of crisis to start to address some of those challenges creatively. I desperately hope that we will see funding come out of Congress that is very much needed to support our institutions. And I hope it has the flexibility to allow our institutions to meet this moment creatively.
Andrew, to that end, I was reading online that one of your first decisions upon assuming the presidency was to jump on the F-1 visa debacle happening. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that and what your role was in informing that for your member institutions?
Yeah, so, you know, I guess no one should be astounded by decisions of the administration at this point that work against our own collective economic or educational interests. The idea that we would take steps to bar international students at a moment of such crisis, it was, I think, astounding to folks on every side of the aisle and every end of the political spectrum. So I'm glad that it was reconsidered. I was glad to be in a small voice of support in MIT and Harvard's case against that decision. And I hope we'll continue to work with Homeland, as we did after 9/11 on the CVIS system, on developing best practices to support our international students. I think we're actually going to have a long way to go to recapture the international market after the COVID crisis. And we really
That's
need
right.
to partner with the government to do that well. It is critical for the needs that we have to grow our institutions and to grow our workforce, that we have a thriving and flourishing international population continuing to come into our institutions. They are of a tremendous support and bring a wonderful perspective. We should be continuing to support that, and I was glad to be an advocate for that. But there's almost an issue. It's like playing whack-a-mole, an issue a day with thinking about how we care for international students, how we support Dreamers, how we think about our students in general, how we maintain the kind of funding we need to have in higher education. And so that end of work that never ends in trying to get back to a level of partnership with our partners in government one of you asked me at the outset about the skepticism towards higher education, and I think that's one of the areas that we really need to tackle head on. Higher education is one of the great gifts of our economy and our society. My former boss, Lynn Pascarella, wrote a beautiful piece and published about the importance of our educational system to our democracy, to having an educated populace. And I don't think those things can be teased apart. I think the success of our economic systems is dependent on supporting social mobility and transformation, the idea that everybody can get access to this incredible educational system, become successful, and connect. And now that has been true more in legend often than in reality. We need to bring that reality closer, but we have it, I think, to a greater extent than anywhere else in the world. And we need to double down on that incredibly powerful system and protect it. And without protecting it in a way that means that we're not willing to change it, but protect it in terms of recognizing the tremendous value that it brings, and that investing in continuing to evolve it is one of our fastest ways towards greater economic prosperity.
That's well said. And
Mic drop for that one.
Well, a big part of that, and I want to bring this up because I think this is a hard question to answer, and it's, you know, tell me what you think, but, you know, skepticism for higher education has come from many different areas. You know, there's the question of the value of a college degree. There's admission scandals. There's all different things out there that have created a skepticism about the institution of higher education. Unfortunately, because I'm with you, I agree with you wholeheartedly that we should be doubling down on educating people, not talking about ways to not become educated, right? So, but a big part of that is really going to come out. You know, COVID has forced institutions into a really uncomfortable position in many ways, right? Because you want to have students on campus, you want to provide environment that, you know, for the 18-year-old, that's the rite of passage to adulthood and the college experience. Many institutions are tuition dependent and are worried about declines in enrollment. And so it puts a lot of pressure on decision-making that could put tuition amounts for online learning. There's just all different questions that may either contribute to or eliminate the skepticism. Are those types of things being talked about at the consortial level? You know, what if we do this? What if we do that? What are the consequences of this? What are the consequences of that? So that, you know, I'm assuming your institutions are able to really learn from each other, or at least get advice from one another on what the future is going to hold.
Yeah, I'll come back to that. I think one of the great strengths of higher education is having the opportunity to bring really brilliant leadership together and have them work together and learn from each other. But I want to start with the obviously we have an inflection point, not just in higher education, but in our society, where everything, every issue, and I don't know how much from a communication standpoint, how much of this is fed by social media or by the moment, but everything's painted as us versus them. And if you get an opportunity, it was interesting. I listened to a piece that Dan Rather did, and he said, you know, we've been here before in moments during the Vietnam War and the civil rights era. We were painting everyone as one side or the other, and everyone was lamenting that there was no way we could get past this, that we could never have the resiliency to pull together again in the same direction. And he spoke with such brilliant optimism about the American experiment and its potential for pulling us together. And I believe in that, particularly around the higher education. And I've been unpleasantly surprised by the volume of essays that have or editorials that have been published that paint this picture of university administrators as willing to risk people's lives to save dollars. I don't know a single university administrator that is not working every day to figure out ways to protect the safety of their community. They are also thinking every day about their most vulnerable students and faculty members and how to make sure that they have a place to go, that they have jobs to come back to. And so this idea that it's about making money is, to me, it's just a tremendous red herring and a distraction. I haven't talked to a single president that's what they're spending their time worrying about. I've talked to a lot of presidents that are saying, how do I protect my groundskeepers, my folks who work in facilities? How do I make sure that my skilled tradespeople have jobs to come back to? How do I make sure that I can maintain my contracts with all these dining service and other folks, and so that they have jobs to come back to? And so there are a tremendous level of a thought every day going into protecting our communities, thinking about all of the people that our campuses are responsible for and how we keep them safe and how we protect them over the long run and protect our educational product and our communities. So I've written in a couple places, and I'm working with one of our presidents on an essay, and it comes back to, and I just heard actually one of the Republican senators saying quite eloquently on the Meet the Press Daily, and he said, you know, it's not us versus them, it's all of us versus a virus. And I think we have to bear that in mind every day. As everyone I know, from every faculty member, every person working in residence life, the presidents, the CFOs, they are working in just round the clock trying to figure this out. That no one has slept, no one has taken time off. It is a endless task. And I know that faculty are exhausted. Being asked to do the job. I've taught courses, the idea of trying to stand up a course that you're going to prepare for doing it in person, online, and both is unreal and an overwhelming task. And everyone is trying to do that. You know, there used to be, back before any of you were born, there was the Ed Sullivan Show, and a guy would come on who was spinning plates. And he would have all these plates spinning in the air, and before one would wobble, he had to go spin the next one. He'd have all these plates on the stage. He'd be running around frantically, spinning plates everywhere. And I think about that as this leadership moment, that folks are just running around frantically, watching the next thing start to wobble and spinning the plate. And I'm not apologizing for anyone. I'm just trying to acknowledge that I think everyone is exhausted. Everyone is doing everything they can to do the right thing. And I think if we can start to move our conversation to start with some mercy for one another, to recognize that contribution that folks are genuinely trying to make, it will ease the relationships considerably. We talked earlier about the transformative power that faculty have. I think the most transformative power is when faculty and administrators can collaborate together to do the right thing. And this is a moment when I think, I believe very deeply that is so desperately needed. So yes, I think I wandered far as is my tendency from your question. But the starting point was, are they learning from each other? Yes, I think one of the great strengths of having a consortial organization is not only do my presidents get to meet together and compare notes, but I have a weekly meeting of the emergency managers from all 17 institutions. We have a weekly meeting of the reopening committees from the various institutions, the government relations people, the communications people. So we are trying where possible to be in touch with each other, be of support to each other, and be communicating with each other about what needs to come next. And at the same time, you're every day making decisions in real time. I was talking with a government official that we were working with on one of the major issues, and she said, we gather every day, and we're working as fast as we can to build sandcastles while the tide is roaring in. And I think there is this feeling that I'll add that one of the things that disappointed me most was someone who I consider a longtime friend and colleague wrote a piece about what a waste of time administrators had made trying so hard to open in person. And I just thought it was such a thoughtless piece to write at this moment. I think administrators, with the data that they had at hand, have been doing everything they can to do the right thing for every member of their communities. And the fact that the data nationally has gotten worse is appalling to all of us. And the fact that will mean that several campuses can't open should be something that we're all sad about, and certainly not an occasion for taunting individuals who have been working their guts out to do the right thing.
Well said, and I will tell you, and I think that's one of the reasons that we're seeing our listenership at the EdUp Experience, frankly, explode, is because we're bringing on college and university presidents, people like yourself, consortial presidents, people at the top that are making the hardest set of decisions of their lifetime right now because of the lives that a number of lives affected, and giving them a platform to say, here's the things I have to consider. This is what it really looks like. I mean, we had a gentleman on the other day, a president, I can't remember what the college was, but you know, he just said, I just have to say, I don't know when I don't
University
know.
University of Ozark.
University of Ozark. Yeah. Rich, I have to go figure it out. I've got to just say, I am not sure because I just don't know. I have no idea. I'm dealing with things. President of Walden University, Ward Ulmer, says, my entire life over the last 4 months has been having the uncomfortable conversation. It's things that I would never have ever thought of to do. So I think you're right on. You know, the number of considerations.
I think at its heart, though, and I tweeted about this the other day, But what I'm seeing is that these leaders are demonstrating what compassionate leadership looks like. Mm-hmm. I have rarely found, I have not yet found, certainly in my consortium and in the other presidents that have called me into consult or chat, a single president who isn't agonizing over how to protect people's lives and how to protect people's jobs, how to make sure their students are safe and that their people are protected. And they're making their decisions from, I mean, these folks are doing everything. These are, you know, smart people surrounded by brilliant people getting, as we all are, a lot of conflicting advice and trying to navigate the best path forward. So I think if we can have some mercy for one another, you know, I was so delighted that my son in his tiny little graduation class decided to give a graduation speech. And he said, in his speech, I won't get his words exactly right, but he said, you know, people are going to tell you that you shouldn't feel bad right now because other people have had it so much worse or other people have it so much worse. And he said, it's okay to feel bad because we're going through something and it's okay to feel it. But then you have to use that to acknowledge that we still have so much. And so use that fear and use that anxiety and use that pain to go do the right thing and help make change, help make things better. And so I'm expressing an incredibly proud father moment. And I had to reread it later because I was crying so hard as he was talking. So you'll forgive me. But that message, I think, is what I'm seeing in these presidents. They are feeling it in their gut every day, and then they're going out and doing everything they can to truly to do the right thing. And I think faculty are doing that. I think staff, my God, the staff who are still on campus with students every day, when we talk about frontline workers, we have them in our hospitals, in our residence halls, in our groundskeepers, in our facilities people, the folks who are cleaning our offices and our residence halls. So we have to acknowledge that we have these heroes among us, and they're part of our community. And so we're all working hard to support that. We all want to see us come out on the other side. And, you know, we're going to get there. It's going to get better. And I hope on the other side, what we'll see is we've built more resilient communities, institutions, and students. And we've done it in ways that we can look back and be really proud of.
Well, you've said it all, Dr. Andrew Flagel. Liz,
As my wife would say, that's the biggest problem is I won't stop saying it all.
But we appreciate it.
I found my niche. If I doing it on a podcast is really
that's right.
We appreciate coming on. I think this has been insightful and. Thank you for your time. A very, very fast, funny story for our listeners. Dr. Flagel here came on while Liz and I were talking about podcast microphones. So he thought he was coming on to talk to us about microphones. And we had to remind him that we were talking about higher education. So he was a little confused, but we like to keep you on your toes here at the EdUp Experience. Dr. Flagel, thank you for coming on. It's been an amazing experience. Liz, thank you for your amazing co-host abilities. Yeah, it's just been amazing. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was great to talk with both of you and glad to do it anytime.
Interested in some fresh marketing ideas that have been real-world tested by colleges and universities and actually work? We'd love to share. Come download MDT Marketing's free 2020 Marketing Strategies Guide, filled with stats and highlights on digital marketing initiatives exclusively for colleges and universities. Download the strategies guide for free at learn.mdtmarketing.com. MDT Marketing has been a leader in delivering marketing solutions for institutes of higher education since 1995. Come leverage our knowledge and download our strategies guide at learn.mdtmarketing.com.
Hope you enjoyed that episode. To learn more about the EdUp Experience, please visit edupexperience.com And if you want to be in on the live recordings, please sign up for our email list. Go to edupexperience.com and sign up to be a subscriber. We'll let you know how you can listen in live and get the scoop before anyone else does. So please, as always, feel free to share this podcast, rate, review, and subscribe. We would really, really appreciate that. You've been listening to The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, with your hosts, Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Liva, and Elvin Freitas.